Let us now turn to the Word of God to consider together the content of the Psalm 11, another one of the Psalms of David. And it is one that he passes to the chief musician to be made use of by others. The psalmist isn't just simply recording his own thoughts or his own meditations, but his experiences he considers, and of course we know that he's led by the Spirit of God, he's been guided by the Spirit of God, but even though that is the case, he wants to share his experiences with others. He wants others to benefit from what he has learned in his experiences with God. And these psalms like this teach us that when the Lord deals with ourselves, it isn't just for our benefit, but it ought to be for the benefit of others. We ought to be able to help others because of what we've experienced in the Lord dealing with ourselves. And so the psalmist here doesn't confine what he states merely to himself. He gives it to the chief musician that others might benefit from it, and you and I likewise. And so when we consider it, we want to learn from it and we want to profit personally from what we read. Now right away, in the opening words of the psalm, it should be obvious to us that this is a reference to the faith of the psalmist. It is a statement of his own practical faith. It isn't just an intellectual faith or a historical faith. It is a real, it is a practical faith because of what the psalmist believes that causes him to act and to adopt the attitudes that he does. His faith is seen in his actions and in his attitudes. You remember what James, in the epistle of James, what he writes, that faith without works is dead. It is just unreal. Faith without works is worthless. It is dead. And James says, show me your faith, I will show you my faith. I will show you my faith. I won't talk about it. I won't describe it to you. I won't seek to define it or expound it or explain it. But I will show you what I believe by my works. You will know as you observe me how I live, how I speak, how I conduct myself. You will know from that what my faith is. And that is something that I believe so often is completely overlooked. And we will argue and we will debate about Calvinism or Arminianism or dispensationalism or antinomianism or whatever we want. And there are countless hours spent in argument, in debate, and it achieves nothing, only very often bitterness of spirit, one party opposing the other. What the world is desperately in need of is to see real biblical Christianity, to see Christianity lived out in the lives of people. And that in reality is the inescapable fact. What we believe is not what we say we believe, but how we show what we believe by our lives. Now in this psalm, this short psalm, you can see that immediately, as soon as we begin to read it, the psalmist is speaking about trust. But he's speaking about personal trust in the Lord put I my trust. He's not ashamed to declare it to us, his faith. He speaks openly of it. But he, as we read through the psalm, you can see that his faith is not something he merely talks about, but it is something that he puts into practice. Now, you see in the context, he's being given advice. And it would seem from the context that the advice is from his friends, not his enemies, but his friends. And yet it is advice that he is disinclined to take. What do we read? In the Lord put I my trust. How say ye to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain? Now there are different opinions as to when the psalmist actually would have penned the words of this psalm, what the circumstances were. The majority seem to think that it was during the reign of Saul, when not only before he was anointed, but when he was actually in the court of Saul and playing music to soothe the mind, the troubled mind of Saul. And you remember Saul threw a javelin at him. He tried to kill him. He was constantly in danger in the presence of Saul. And some believe that this is why the psalmist was writing this psalm, because there were those who knew of the danger that he was in. His life was under threat, and they were advising him, for your own sake, flee as a bird to the mountain. Now, this was well-meant advice. We don't doubt that for a moment. And yet, the psalmist sees it as a temptation. He knew his danger just as much as those who around him knew it. He knew how that Saul would on occasions be extremely agitated, and he certainly would try to destroy him. But David doesn't say he's going to flee. Instead, he says, in the Lord put I my trust, and so I will stay at my post, I will do my duty, and I will put my trust in the Lord Jehovah. Now, you can see how beneficial this is, the attitude that he adopts, because when we go over to Psalm 40, for example, we read in verse 4, blessed is the man that maketh the Lord his trust. Blessed is the man that maketh the Lord his trust. And when the psalmist says, in the Lord put I my trust, it's very obvious he's in a blessed position, in a blessed state. He's blessed indeed. Whatever his circumstances, however adverse they might be, however threatening, however dangerous, here's a man blessed in the midst of all that danger. He's blessed in his spirit and in his soul in the midst of all that is threatening around him. In the Lord put I my trust. And what they were saying to him was, flee as a bird to your mountain, because that was a regular thing. When men were threatened, you see even down through history, beyond biblical history, in the history of the Huguenots and so on, when they were under persecution, they fled to the mountains, and they lived and hid in caves and so on, seeking to escape from their persecutors. And this is the advice that the psalmist has been given. Flee to the mountains. There's no shame in it. There's no harm in it. It seems sensible. It's the right thing to do. Preserve your life, that you might be useful to us in the future. But the psalmist says, in the Lord put I my trust. I'm not trusting in the mountain. I'm not trusting in the safety that others flee to. I am trusting in the Lord. And you see in Hebrews 13 where the people of God go whenever they're in straits, just as the psalmist was, and the attitude they adopt in chapter 13. The words read, let your conversation be without covetousness and be content with such things as you have, for he has said. What a difference it makes when we remember and we pay attention to what God has said. What a difference it makes. And here's what the apostle says, let your conversation be without covetousness and be content with such things as you have. Why? For he has said. Who has said? God has said. He has said something, and that settles the matter for me. He has said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee, so that we may boldly say. Isn't that a wonderful connection? He has said, and because of what he has said, then listen to what I can say. I can only say what I'm saying because of what he has said. And what has he said? I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. And because I know he has said that, then I can boldly say, the Lord is my helper, and I will not fear what man shall do unto me. Why is the psalmist so bold here? In the Lord put I my trust, my unshakable trust, my unshakable confidence, because of what God has said. He has said he will never leave me and he will never forsake me. So therefore I can boldly say, in the Lord put I my trust. In the book of Proverbs, again, that book full of wisdom, in the chapter 28 of Proverbs, we read in verse 25, he that is of a proud heart stirreth up strife, but he that putteth his trust in the Lord shall be made fat or prosperous. He that trusteth in his own heart is a fool. Now there are those, and they sincerely imagine, I'm trusting in the Lord. But in reality, what they're doing is trusting in their own hearts. They're trusting in their own feelings. And you will hear people say, well, my head tells me to do this, but my heart tells me to do that. And people think that they can be confident. They think they're secure if they follow their hearts. But what does the wise sage of old say? He that trusteth in his own heart is a fool. And so the psalmist, he says, I will not even trust myself. And I will not trust even in my own heart. But my trust will be solely in the Lord. You will, I'm sure, have noted when we were reading through that Psalm 62, how many times we read only, only, only. In the Lord only will I trust, and so on. And that's what the psalmist is doing. Now, you will see that this faith that the psalmist confesses is a very focused faith. He knows exactly in whom he's putting his trust. In the Lord put I my trust. He doesn't say in the Lord I share my trust. All my trust, all my confidence, All my faith is in him. And look at what we read in verse 4. The Lord that he's trusting in the Lord put I my trust. Verse 4, this Lord that I'm trusting in, where is he? He is in his holy temple. My, isn't it good? The psalmist knows where God is. He's not running around in his distress searching for God, trying to find God. He knows God, but he knows he has access to God. He knows where God is. God is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in the heaven. Now what has he been advised to do? Flee as a bird to your mountain. The psalmist has no intention of fleeing to a mountain because he has got his eye on the throne that is higher than any mountain. And he flees to the throne. He says, the Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. Whatever man is trying to do, he can't touch that throne. And however much he may rant and he may disagree with God's sovereign dealings and rulings, God's throne remains secure. And that's why the psalmist says, in the Lord put I my trust. Because the focus of my faith is in someone whose throne is absolutely secure. And it is higher than any mountain that I might try to flee to. But this is then what he says. His eyes, behold, his eyelids try the children of men. And the psalmist is well aware that God is observing everything that's going on from his throne. There's nothing he doesn't see. There's nothing he doesn't know. But the psalmist says, his eyes, behold, his eyelids try the children of men. God doesn't just look on as an observer. He examines the hearts, he examines the motives of men, he tests their motives and their works and their actions and so on. But this is why the psalmist puts his trust in God, because he knows from experience of the omniscience of God. The God that I'm trusting in knows everything far beyond anything I know. You remember when you go back to the book of Genesis, we sometimes quote the words about in Genesis chapter 16. You have this poor woman, Hagar, and she's fled from Sarah, and she's in the wilderness. She has no sustenance. It seems she has no help. But she discovers something. It's amazing, you know, what the people of God sometimes discover in the wilderness. They learn things there, they discover things there they won't discover and they won't learn anywhere else. And you have Hagar, she has to flee whenever her mistress deals severely with her. And in verse 7, when she's in the wilderness, the angel of the Lord, Genesis 16, verse 7, the angel of the Lord found her by a fountain of water in the wilderness. I'm sure if you had sat down with Hagar and you had asked her, what was it like to be in the wilderness? She wouldn't be telling you it was physically and materially very comfortable, that it was pleasant. It was the very opposite. She had so lost heart. She was so distressed. She thought, My very child is going to die. I don't even want to see him dying, but there's not a thing I can do. I'm helpless. I'm hopeless. Here I am in the wilderness by the fountain, the way of Shur. And he said, Hagar, Sarah's maid, whence camest thou? Whither wilt thou go? She said, I flee from the face of my mistress Sarah. Now here is somebody fleeing from distress, fleeing from discomfort, fleeing from persecution, as it were. Then the angel of the Lord speaks to her and gives her advice, gives her counsel, gives her promises. And then we're told in verse 13 how she responded. She called the name of the Lord that speak unto her. She was mindful it was the Lord was speaking. She didn't hear that voice when she was secure in the household of Abraham. But in the wilderness, amidst all her distress, amidst all that was so unfamiliar and so uncomfortable, she learned something that she never would have learned had she not been there. Those were the circumstances that brought her into the very place where then when God spoke, it really meant something. And we're told she called the name of the Lord that spake unto her, Thy God seest me. The wilderness, when she was in the household of Abraham, you know what God said about his house? I know him, that he will obey me. He will instruct his household in the ways of the Lord and so on. Now, she would have been there listening to her master, explaining the covenant of God, teaching about the one true God and so on. Here she is all alone now in the wilderness. But God comes to her in the wilderness and God speaks to her and she becomes very aware of, because of her experience with God, she then is able to speak of God. She has insight, personal insight, into the character and the being, the mercy, the grace of God. She's learning things about God in the wilderness she wouldn't have learned anywhere else. And she said, Thy God seest me. And it wasn't just that she was aware that God was conscious of her presence there. She said, Thy God seest me. In the wilderness, it would seem there's not a soul in sight. There's not one to give any attention to this perishing woman. Then she says, Thy God seest me. You see me in my need. You see me in my want. You see me in my distress. Thy God seest me, for she said, Have I also looked after him that seeth me? Here, what has she learned? God saw her before she saw him. Isn't that amazing? Have I also here looked after him that seeth me? She becomes aware. He had his eye on me before ever I saw him, before ever I knew him, before I was ever aware of him. Thou God seest me, and it's because God sees me, I'm now seeing him. And then you can see how she goes back to her mistress and is submissive to her. But this is what she's learned from her experience, a bitter experience, a real trial of an experience. But she becomes aware of God in a way she previously was totally unaware. And then you can see in the psalmist, his experience here, his eyes behold, his eyelids try the children of men. Why am I trusting in him? Because he sees my danger. He knows perfectly all my circumstances. He knows everything about me. And therefore I'm going to trust him. And you know, sometimes we forget that. And we think, well, God probably knows a few things, but does he know everything? Does he know how near the edge I am? Does he know how I feel so weak and so feeble, almost undone? Yes, Hagar, God sees Hagar. And God sees the psalmist. And then, this is what he has to say. His faith is focused in God, who knows everything, who's ruling from his throne. But then, the faith that he puts, the trust that he puts in God is faith. God tries it. He tests it. He tries it. And what does he say? The Lord trieth the righteous. That's the one I'm trusting in. And because I'm trusting in him, I expect him to try me. I expect him on occasions to test me, to test my faith, to try my faith. It's one thing for me to say, in the Lord I trust. But then I have to discover that I'm really trusting him. I'm not just saying it. He puts me into circumstances. He brings me into situations not of my own making, but he, from the throne, he arranges it, he purposes it, he works it all out according to his plan for my benefit. One of the old divines, I can't remember which one it was, but he said, if we try to avoid trials, we deny ourselves a blessing. If we try to avoid a trial, we actually deny ourselves a blessing, because the trial of our faith is precious. And when it is tried, it becomes a blessing, because we discover who God really is. We have a development of our faith. We have growth and grace and so on. Now, the psalmist says, the Lord trieth the righteous, but the wicked and him that loveth violence, his soul hateth. And the psalmist isn't intending to flee to the mountain as a bird for safety, because he believes the circumstances that I'm in, however difficult, however dangerous, however others may view them, God is testing me to see if I really do trust him. It's interesting, you know, if you go back to the book of Numbers, there in the book of Numbers in the chapter 15, God gave instruction to the Israelites of old, amidst all the various instructions. He gave them in the males instruction about their appearance, their apparel. And verse 37 of Numbers chapter 15, the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, and bid them that they make them fringes in the borders of their garments throughout their generations, and that they put upon the fringe of the borders a ribbon of blue. Now, I am sure that you have come across portraits, or supposed to be portraits, or paintings. Artists take all kinds of liberties painting the Son of God in our nature, painting the Savior. and they will show him fair-haired with a beard and so on, and dressed in some kind of a tunic. The Savior fulfilled all righteousness. He kept the law, and he kept it perfectly. And he, growing up in his society, was under an obligation to dress in a certain way. And the males were, the woman could see it, children could see their father, everyone was to take note of this ribbon of blue, these tassels, and the Orthodox Jews still wear them today. They were to dress with this for a reason. It shall be, verse 39, unto you for a fringe, that ye may look upon it. They were to give attention to it. It wasn't just a fashion statement. It had a purpose, a divine purpose. Look upon it and remember all the commandments of the Lord and do them. And that ye seek not, listen, ye seek not after your own heart and your own eyes, after which ye go used to go a-whoring. Now look at the order. Look at the concern of God. Why he tells them to do this? You would be thinking, surely, because of what God says, ye shall look upon it, it shall be unto you for a fringe, that ye may look upon it. Now that would seem to indicate that's the priority. You look on it for a reason. And yet, what does God say? You shall look upon it and remember all the commandments of the Lord and do them, that ye seek not after your own heart and your own eyes. The heart comes before the eyes. Now, naturally, we would think the eyes should come first. It's what you see. You remember what Jesus taught? If a man looks upon a woman to lust after her, that's the sight, that's the lusting he sees. He looks on her. He hath committed adultery already in his heart. It's not the eyes that lead the heart. It's the heart that leads the eyes. That's what God's saying. You Israelites, you have to look and you have to learn and you have to remember, but you must look with your heart. And what does God say? That you may seek not after your own heart and your own eyes, after which ye used to go a-whoring. The actions come third. The heart leads the eyes, and the eyes lead to the activity. That's the order. That ye may remember and do all my commandments, and be holy unto your God. I am the Lord your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord your God. What does God want them to remember? He gives them this article of clothing so that they will never forget to trust him. He brought them out of Egypt. He redeemed them. Now they are to trust him. They're not in Egypt now, but they are still to trust him. They are still to remember his commandments. You go back and perhaps in the historical context, perhaps God had very good reason at the particular time that he said this to do it. Because when we go back to chapter 13, two chapters earlier, we have the record of the spies being sent into the land that was promised to them. God said it flowed with milk and honey. That was the land that he promised to them. a land flowing with milk and honey. And God promised all these blessings, but before they enter the land, their faith in God is tested. The promise hasn't changed. God's description is not in any error. The land is a good land. It's a land flowing with milk and honey, as God said. But do they really believe God? You remember we read in Hebrews? We see they could not enter in because of unbelief. They had the promise, but they didn't believe it. They didn't believe God. Now look at what happens without going into all the details. In Numbers chapter 13, we read verse 30, when the spies come back from the land, this is what happens, verse 30 of Numbers 13. Caleb stilled the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it." Let's move right away. Waste no time. Let's act upon God's promise. He told us he would give us this land. Let's go and take possession of it. You notice how he puts it. Caleb stilled the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and possess it." That's all we have to do, take it. We are well able to overcome it. The servant of the Lord, Caleb, he knew, yes, we'll have to fight, yes, we'll have to use our arms, as it were, and whatever we need to overcome enemies, but in the end, God's going to give us the land, as he promised. Verse 31, "But the men that went up with him said, 'We be not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we.' And they brought up an evil report of the land which they had searched unto the children of Israel." Now, you will see that Caleb and the other spies, they all saw the same picture. They were looking on the same scene. They weren't going here, there, yonder, wandering around as individuals. They saw the same land. They saw the same cities. They saw the same inhabitants. And yet, though they were looking at the same scene, they saw it completely differently. And how often, you see, this is what was happening in the experience of the psalmist. They're saying, "Flee, David, for your own safety. We care for you. We don't want to see you harmed. Saul intends evil against you, so you flee to the mountain and be saved." And David isn't intending to do that because he's trusting in the Lord, who is on a higher throne than ever Saul will ever sit on. And here is David being advised by those who see the situation he's in. David also sees it, the same situation, but he looks at it with different eyes. And that's what happened when these men went into the land of Canaan. They saw the same things, but they saw them through different eyes. And so often that happens in the experience of God's people. One sees exactly the same as the other, but they see it with different eyes. And what do we read here? They brought up an evil report. They searched the land. The land through which we have gone to search it is a land that eateth up the inhabitants thereof. God never said that. And all the people that we saw in it are men of great stature. And there we saw the giants, the sons of Anak, which come of the giants. And we were in our own sight as grasshoppers. Now once unbelief and distrust of God, once it gets a hold on the mind, it just gets worse. And look at how they exaggerate here. They didn't believe God. They painted a different picture altogether. And they said, we were in our own sight as grasshoppers when we saw these giants. We compared ourselves with them. Now, we might well ask, Caleb, did you actually see these giants? Of course he did. And yet you're saying we're well able to go in and possess it, and these men are saying there's no way we can do it. And we were in our own sight as grasshoppers. Well, that was good. And so were we in their sight. How did they know? You see, whenever unbelief comes in and takes control and gets a hold of us, every threat, every danger, every trial becomes exaggerated. That's the truth of it. And they were saying, not only are we like grasshoppers in our own sight, but we penetrated their minds. We're like grasshoppers in their sight. You see where unbelief will take us once it gets a hold. And the thing is, when we come back to the Psalm 11, the advisors who meant well, no doubt, when they're advising David, they saw his circumstances, but he also saw them. And he, instead of fleeing to the mountain, he looks to the throne, and he is aware of this fact. God is ruling, and he's reigning, and his eye is upon me, and these circumstances aren't an accident. The very fact that Saul would try to kill me, it all fits into the purpose of God. And God is testing me to see, do I really trust him? And you see the strength of his faith. We read at the end of the psalm, verse 7, the righteous Lord loveth righteousness, his countenance doth behold the upright. And the psalmist is conscious of this. God sees everything. He hasn't overlooked anything. He's not blind to what's going on. The Lord, verse 5, trieth the righteous. Now you can see the difference in God's dealings with the righteous or the godly and the wicked. And the difference sometimes between what God is doing with his own child and with one who is his enemy, their circumstances on the surface may be almost identical. Here's a godly man, godly woman. Here's an ungodly man. Here's an ungodly woman. And when we look at their experiences, they're the same. We look at their trials and their afflictions, they're basically the same. Is then this unjust on the part of God? Of course not. The difference is that when we consider from the throne of God
that there is a purpose behind it, we're not to read into these circumstances. We're not to judge them as by the degree of suffering or pain or anxiety, but rather the design behind them. And that is so often, you see, where the child of God stumbles. They look, well, what's the point of me serving God? I'm just suffering as much as that ungodly person. My trials are as severe. And we begin to judge the justice of God. But you see, we miss out. Instead of the degree of pain or anxiety, it's the design behind it that we should look at. And the psalmist is able to say, when he considers all these things, in the Lord put I my trust. Why would I trust anyone else? In thee, in the Lord, put I my trust. He is the Lord that is good, and he is the Lord that doeth good. And therefore, when the psalmist is sharing this experience, he wants you and I to benefit from it. And he wants us to do what he has done and to be able to say in honesty, in the Lord put I my trust. He has designed perfectly my circumstances, the particular trial, because the Lord trieth the righteous. He tried Daniel. He tried the three Hebrews. He has tried Abraham. He's tried Isaac. He's tried Jacob. He's tried his saints, Job. He has tried them again and again. But when he tries them, there's a blessing in it. And we shall leave it there. May God bless his word.